And we're back. Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Shortly, we'll be talking to Stephen Gowans. He wrote an article at gowans.wordpress.com. And I just mentioned that Americans are taking umbrage that President Putin of Russia is interfering with the civil war issue in Syria. And I want to point out that when the Russians came to the aid of President Lincoln in 1863, nobody complained. And by the way, Lincoln, to use the contemporary language, had killed 600,000 of his own people, 600,000, which makes President Assad a piker, according to this language. And the British and the French said that something had to be done. And they were talking together about interfering in the American Civil War. Neutral, friendly to the Confederates, that is, the slave owners. That is a fact. Look it up. The British and the French decided they were going to try to do something. And this month, in September 1863, the Russian fleet arrived, ships from the Russian fleet, in New York Harbor. They also, in October 1863, they arrived in the San Francisco Harbor. And in San Francisco, they were particularly appreciated because there was a threat of a Confederate vessel. There was a rumor to be coming to San Francisco. The Russian captain outfitted his ship to defend America from the interference by the British. So no complaints at that time that the Russians interfered in the American Civil War, where Lincoln had killed half a million people. Anyway, we are joined now, I believe, by Stephen Gowans. You there, sir?
I'm here, Bill. How are you?
Very good. I was just talking about how the Russians get into interfering in all these things. and obviously, that's kind of a lead matter. You've written a piece now at gowans.wordpress.com called Counter Questions on Syria. And we seem to have a difference of opinion about who gets to invoke international mores and laws and such. And your starting point is that President Obama, in explaining himself, really overstepped and actually tried to mislead his audience as to what the rights and duties of a state are. Could you elaborate on that?
I mean, the Obama administration wanted to make the case that the Syrian government, A, had used chemical weapons, and it hasn't made that case. But that's the case it wants to make. And in using chemical weapons, it has violated what Obama and Kerry have called the international system and international rules. They're very careful about the words they use, or international norms. But they didn't say international law, because it's unclear that if indeed the Syrian government had used chemical weapons, that it violated any international law, because it's not party to one of the treaties that prohibits the stockpiling and use of chemical weapons. It is a party to an earlier law, the Geneva Accord, regarding the use of chemical weapons between states. But in this case, if indeed the Syrian government had used chemical weapons, it had used it within the context or within the state and not in a war between states. So there's really no sound ground in international law to say that Syria, if indeed it had used chemical weapons, had violated any international law. So the Obama administration has been very careful in the words it's using, trying to create the impression that there is a case in international law to punish the Syrian government by referring to violations of an international system or international rules or international norms. But these are essentially just rules that Obama himself is making up on the spot. And he's anointing himself as kind of the world emperor who's going to enforce these laws, which he indeed has made himself and is trying to pass off as international law.
Yeah, and occasionally violated, right?
I mean, and violates. Oh, yeah. And indeed, what he proposed to do. I mean, he has no high regard for international law, because the very act that he had been proposing initially, which was to bomb Syria to punish the Syrian government for its alleged use of chemical weapons, would be a flagrant violation of the, you know, authentic international system that Obama deceptively claims that he wishes to uphold.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that would be a clear violation of international law to decide that, you know, the United States is going to unilaterally, or with French participation and with Canada cheering it along, you know, punish the Syrian government.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Stephen Gowans. His article is Counter Questions on Syria. It's a September 1 of this year at gowans.wordpress.com. Stephen, you raise the old proverb, but he who says A must also say B. If the subject is going to be chemical and biological weapons and weapons of mass destruction, the tack you take is, well, maybe we're at the wrong side is asking this question. I'm thinking, for example, I just read a piece that says that the United States signed that agreement, that they would not only identify themselves as part of this process and all that, but that they were going to destroy their chemical biological weapons. But they've asked for a special status and something like a 10-year wait period before they think they can accomplish it.
Mm-hmm.
Your tack is to say, why don't we take all of Obama's questions and interrogate him? Am I right?
Yes. And just to kind of amplify that point, I've been reading the Times of London, not because I wanted to, but because it was the only thing available to me at the time. And there was a long discussion about Syria has the third largest stockpiles of chemical weapons in the world. It kept reminding me of this. This was in the context of a discussion about, you know, an arrangement between the United States and Russia to have Syria disarm, destroy its chemical weapons. What the article didn't mention is that if Syria was number three, who's number one and two?
Yes.
The United States and Russia.
Yes.
So here the United States and Russia with the world's largest stockpiles of chemical weapons, especially the United States, I mean, dictating to Syria that it must obey international norms and get rid of all of its chemical weapons. Well, it's true that the United States has committed to destroying its chemical weapons, but it committed to do that quite some time ago, and it still has the world's largest stockpiles, and it's missed its deadlines for destroying those chemical weapons. So that's...
Yeah. This, I think, has been moved back at least 10 years. I think the date I saw, I think, was, 2023, I guess.
Yeah. They say it's very difficult to destroy these stockpiles, but the Syrian government is supposed to...
But they were prepared to hit unknown stockpiles with a Tomahawk missile. What did they... by the way, did anybody ever ask that question? If you're going to... you don't want him to have it, and then you hit it with an explosive. I'm just a, you know, layman, but it sounds kind of dangerous.
Yes, it does. you're asking about, you know, should we ask questions of Obama?
I think the question is, can a cat look at a king, right? Isn't this where we are? We're not really supposed to ask. It's assumed we're not going to ask.
Yeah, we're not going to ask. And Obama's question and Kerry's question is, can we really stand by and allow the Syrian government to kill children? They always mention children mm-hmm. with this vicious chemical weapons attack, again, without any sound evidence that, in fact, the Syrian government was responsible for the attack. And there was Obama asking, you know, a bunch of rhetorical questions about what message will we send if a dictator can gas hundreds of children to death in plain sight and pay no price? But, you know, what message will we send if a president can autocratically appoint to himself the right to bomb other countries without justification and without legitimate authority and pay no price?
Mm-hmm.
which the United States has done on a number of occasions. Obama asked, what message will we send if a dictator can gas hundreds of... Well, I already said that. but what's the purpose of the international system, he asked, that we've built if a prohibition on the use of chemical weapons has been agreed to by the governments of 98% of the world's people? That's interesting. He said 98%. Mm-hmm. Ignoring the fact that, in fact, the Syrian government had not signed on to this convention, and nor, indeed, have Egypt or Israel. It's curious that the Israeli prime minister is saying that he's very happy to see that Syria is going to be destroying its chemical weapons, but no one's asking when Israel is going to do the same.
Yes, but look at the language there. I mean, I'm not even aware that Israel acknowledges possession of chemical, biological. The world seems to be aware and talks about it now openly that they have nuclear, but we actually don't know. Have they acknowledged to your awareness whether or not they even have any of these?
Yeah, officially they won't acknowledge. But, I mean, they won't sign on to any treaty which bans the weapons. Oh, perhaps they don't, and they want people to believe they do, but... I believe that occasionally certain Israeli politicians or officials have let slip that they have the nuclear arsenal. But
but they haven't let the arsenal slip. Yes. This is, by the way, Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com, and the article is titled Counter Questions. Stephen, I'm very curious to know, it seems to me that Putin has done something to demonstrate that Yeltsin is dead. Is he dead? He's certainly not around. Anyhow, there seemed to be somebody else there in Moscow than had been for quite a long stretch. And he raised a point which is presented an editorial problem, editorial writer's problem in the West. He says, you call yourself exceptional. That's a very dangerous thing to say, because we're all equal in the eyes of God. I think I noticed you rubbed that in. How can any editorial writer in Ottawa or London or France disagree with that?
Well, I guess it's
different. Unless they say, well, hey, listen, we're, you know, lapdogs. Don't talk to the master like that.
The American exceptionalism, or we're the indispensable nation and we see further. I mean, just the way of justifying, again, the United States appointing itself as emperor of the world. And then we have our own prime minister, of course, echoing these kinds of views without actually saying that the United States is indispensable and exceptional. Certainly our own prime minister has been talking about how we can't, for example, have Russia anymore vetoing the Security Council, as if the Security Council is an organ of the United States, which is supposed to do the U.S. bidding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by the way, I suppose we should almost appreciate that the Prime Minister has said these things, because once you scrutinize him, you do raise all these interesting problems. Where does he find the notion that they don't get to have that veto? The Russians have not used the veto any more than the Americans have, and the Security Council is the mechanism that evolved out of World War II, by which international peace, that is, true wars, don't take off, right?
Mm-hmm.
When I say true wars, I mean, I wonder if people remember, when we talk so much about Afghanistan, you know, whatever, Iraq, those are interesting, but those aren't wars. Maybe people know something about World War One, and World War Two. Understand the UN was put together so that you won't have one of those.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a prime minister who said, "Oh, the Russians shouldn't have that veto." Can you tell me how they got the veto? Did they do anything important during World War Two? I mean, as important as Harper's Friends?
Yeah. I guess the view that. Well, I guess it's a widely held view, certainly in North America, that the World War II was single-handedly won by the United States, or in Britain, that it was single-handedly won by Britain. But and yes, I mean, certainly ignore the enormous contribution made by the Soviet Union. In fact, you could argue that if any country was responsible for defeating Nazi Germany, if you were going to single out any, you'd have to single out the Soviet Union, indeed.
Mm-hmm. And the all Russians seem to agree on that. Whatever they might think of the Bolsheviks, the Communist Party, etc., or even Soviet history, they, being Russians, they kind of know what happened in World War II. Again, speaking to Stephen Gowans, and Stephen, you know, today Kerry and Cameron and a minister from France whose name escapes me said that they are going to step up armament for the rebels, which crosses one of your red lines again. I mean, threatening to attack somebody and arming and abetting people who are engaged in fighting a sovereign government, that is in violation of international law, is it not?
Yes. And again, I mean, I guess we'd be rather naive to think that the United States or Britain or France really have much regard for international law. And at this point, I mean, realistically speaking, I mean, the United States doesn't have to have any regard for international law because there's no one around to enforce it. Where the United States is concerned, certainly no country can enforce it on the United States,
mm-hmm.
or indeed on any other holder of a United Nations Security Council veto. But one of the interesting things that Putin said, you mentioned Putin's op-ed in the New York Times. One of the things, I mean, and he was making a case for international law, and talking about the dangers of violating international law. And one of the dangers he pointed to was that if you violate international law, if you attack countries in contravention of international law, so under international law you can only attack a country in self-defense, but the United States, of course, attacks many countries not in self-defense,
mm-hmm.
but aggressively. And as he pointed out, if you do that, all you do is that you encourage proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Because as he pointed out, if you have nuclear weapons, it's unlikely that the United States is going to attack you.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, no, the United States doesn't have to abide by international law and doesn't often, but one of the consequences of that is the spread of weapons of mass destruction. To countries that are threatened by the United States. And, I mean, that's one of the tenets of nonproliferation. Don't threaten countries.
Yes.
Don't go beyond international law and threaten countries, threaten to send, you know, cruise missiles into the country, because all you're doing is encouraging them to build weapons of mass destruction to defend themselves.
Yes, if they will do that thing. We've spoken to you about this in the past. There's a number of people, such like Noam Chomsky, said, and he doesn't think Iran, for example, is trying to acquire a nuclear weapon, but he said it would be very understandable if they did, just because they're being threatened by a nuclear power that does not respect their sovereignty. Now, by the way, I want to make sure I ask you about this, because there is a sort of, here we are having a little hiatus, and I don't think it's going to last very long. People feel rather happy that we didn't have a war, or an attack, I should call it. But there is a question about, well, what is the object of the policy? And I remember that when Libya was attacked and they said a no-fly zone and that there was going to be non-interference, the world was lied to blatantly by all of the people in the American administration. As soon as Gaddafi was murdered at the end of that exercise, a cry went up in France and from Mr. Cameron and others, and they said Syria had better look out because they're next. They actually talked like that. And then people said, well, why would you do that? And the answer was Syria, Hezbollah, Iran.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, there seems to be, I notice in people trying to debate this and talk about what's going on, there seems to be kind of a local focus that somehow this is just about Syria. But there is something more strategic at work here involving also Russia, China. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's never local. It's all part of a larger strategy. And I suppose the way to describe that strategy simply is a strategy of ensuring that the United States is top dog. It is the top dog, but I mean, there still is some challenge from Russia, from China, and there still are some countries that zealously guard their independence from the United States, like mm-hmm. Syria or Zimbabwe or Libya.
Mm-hmm. North Korea.
North Korea, yes. Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And these are countries that the United States, of course, would like to see have a change of regime, mm-hmm. a regime that's going to be compliant with or biddable and which will comply with U.S. demands and dictates.
Yeah. By the way, they really had they tasted blood with the Libya thing. You remember how they were talking? And I noticed they're all kind of quiet about it now. I haven't heard from no-fly Clinton for a while, and I noticed some of the others are rather quiet. But they were giving themselves away, saying that they were going to be able to further isolate and eventually break down Islamic Republic, and that Russia would be, of course, get the lesson that they should not be get in the way. I wonder what your thoughts are about how likely this is that the convoy will resume its march. We've had the British Parliament, which maybe in some ways is the more shocking of the developments. I don't hear anybody referring to it, but that might suggest that even within their own ranks, they're having some problems.
Yeah. And I mean, there's this view that perhaps, you know, the arrangement that's now being made between Russia and the United States to have Syria eliminate its chemical weapons is a setback for the United States. And maybe it's not something they initially planned, but I think that they'll exploit it to their advantage. Mm-hmm. And I see already that they're just trying to pave the way to suggesting that, or essentially to repeating the Iraq scenario.
Mm-hmm.
So you can say, well, you know, they committed to reduce or to eliminate their weapons of mass destruction, their chemical weapons, but Assad isn't complying. In fact, there's already talk about, oh, well, we don't think he's going to comply anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can make the case that we should be able to search every nook and cranny of Syria, and
yes.
Syrian government is balking at that, so they're not in compliance, so you know, we have to take it upon ourselves to enforce this UN security resolution.
A Chapter 7.
Yes.
Do a Chapter 7 on them. Yes, I recall that within the case of Saddam Hussein, that they wanted to go into his house.
Yes.
I mean, he couldn't walk down the street or visit his relatives. They, well, now we have to go to your cousin's house and look there. On the face of it, seems unlikely given the way this thing is unfolding. But I suppose you're right that they will attempt that. They do seem to have a sales problem, though, in convincing people that this is how to do this. As I say, we're seeing these problems with the British Parliament. I wonder how they're going to, having taken a stand, you would assume that maybe they rather like the idea that they told the Americans they didn't want something. And Putin seems to have put a lot on the line here by telling him, no, you can't do that. You're going to have to observe international law. I wonder, I'll just ask you this as an analogy. You raised the point about Cuba. We had the missile crisis, a very ugly, dangerous showdown there between the United States and Russia and Cuba. And they said, okay, you got to give up those missiles. And they said, Russia said, okay, we will pull them out. And Fidel said, no, you can't pull them out because they're here. They belong to me now. And he wouldn't allow the United Nations to inspect.
Uh-huh.
He said, yes, you can take them, but the UN is not coming here. And his example he gave was Congo. He said, you said you were going to do that in the Congo, and Mr. Lumumba ended up dead, so we're not the Congo. You're not going to do that. I wonder if we might have a similar phenomenon with Syria.
Well, one would hope that the Syrian government would do that. And, I mean, you could have made the argument that perhaps Syria would have been better off if Russia had not made its proposal. Because, as you said, I mean, the United States was having a very serious problem or sales problem they weren't selling this, and it looked like that Obama may not have got congressional support. Mm-hmm. But now, I mean, he has the potential to create a pretext for an attack by simply arguing that Assad is not complying. And if he doesn't allow inspectors in, you can make the same argument again. It's not complying.
Yeah. Actually, yes. What we're dealing with is it was dangerous, but it could be more dangerous, right? I notice that Mr. Lavrov is saying today, you have to stop threatening them. And by the way, they are a signatory now. They've already agreed. So you can't now, there's nothing in the language, as far as I know, that says you can start to threaten them. And the logic you introduced at the beginning of our interview is, well, actually, if you're going to raise this issue, do it now, that would have to apply to Washington itself. In other words, they can't say to somebody, you do it, and the other guy says, no, I signed the same agreement you did.
Well, that's what makes the United States exceptional. Excepted from all the laws that apply to everyone else.
They're exceptional because they say they're exceptional, which that is exceptional. Stephen, it's great talking to you. That's a wonderful article. I'll bet you're going to be writing a lot more. This is one that requires almost a daily or every 3 or 4 days we're going to have to update ourselves because the U.S. is not resting since it wants to impose its exceptionalists on people. Gowans.wordpress.com. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Okie doke. Bye-bye. Stephen Gowans. And you're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5, right? Yes, I get a little weary. I'll just remind you again that when Russia came to the aid of Abraham Lincoln by sending warships to San Francisco and New York in 1863, Mr. Wells, who he was the Secretary of the Navy, now that's in the United States Navy in 1863. He wrote in his diary, God bless Russia. Because the great powers of the day, other great powers, France and the United States, were threatening the United States. They said, we can't allow this killing to go on. This is terrible. Somebody has to. They didn't use the word, I hadn't heard it yet, humanitarian intervention. But they were saying that they could come and arbitrate and settle the whole thing down. And at that moment, the Russian czar, must have been one of the enlightened ones, we'll call him Peter or something, his name. Anyway, he said no. And, of course, he had his own problem with the British and the French in Poland, where they were also putting their nose in. They had also had invited him to join the attack on it had joined the intervention in the American Civil War, and he had told them no. The Russian government had told them no. Anyhow, I think that's an important precedent. The Americans ought to consider that. You're listening, as I said, to the Taylor Report. Our guests have been Eve Engler, and his article is in Counterpunch, September the 10th. And, of course, Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com. And, again, Friday, September 20, 7 to 9 p.m. at 25 Cecil Street, commemoration of the 80th birthday of the late Charles Roach, and his book of poems, Rapso Prosodies, will be available with refreshments and entertainment. And for the Taylor Report, we will see you next week.